Part 1, The Mindset. Chapter 1, Control is a Good Thing. There are some people who live in a dream world, and there are some who face reality. And then there are those who turn one into the other. Douglas Everett. For many, hearing any version of the statement, "To get what you want, you must have more control," evokes the response that seeking control is a bad thing. They contend that one should relax and go with the flow, stay loose and not worry so much about details, and that seeking more and more control can only mean one is devolving into a nervous control freak. There is an almost cosmological sense, a carryover from the 60s perhaps, that we're all one, and that the problems in our lives and the world around us are due to people who don't share our brand of let-it-be spirituality. If my boss, my spouse, my parents, my children, my neighbor, and or my government would just lighten up and be sensible, like me, then everyone could be happy. Confident in the truth of it, we are eager to proclaim that the states of our lives and of the world are not good. We exhort that people are too uptight, too concerned with tiny details. Allow me to retort. Notwithstanding the possible metaphysical truth of the "we're all one" mantra, it's my contention that being in command of the details of our lives is mandatory if we are to find personal peace and success, if we are to find happiness. Conversely, while we're focusing on those things that are in our control, we must lighten up about those things that are not in our control. If we attempt to control events we can't influence, we're in for disappointment. Is it difficult to determine what we can and cannot control? No, it's not. My generation emphasized a great and useful truth. What's happening now is the most important thing. But I also know that the satisfaction I feel in any particular moment has much to do with the details I've managed in days past. Yes, I try hard to be here now, but I spend some of that here time focusing on actions that will ensure future moments will be under control, efficient, and serene. Wallowing. With my younger brother as an ally, I was brought up in my grandparents' house in a small town in upstate New York. It was a chaotic, unsettled household. At 17, I was on the streets of the Haight District in San Francisco. It was 1967, the summer of love, when I discovered an intriguing escape from the not-so-perfect family situation back home. For 2 years, I traveled around the country, wallowing in sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Well, maybe not that much sex. In the summer of 69, I ended up at the Woodstock Music and Art Fair, the famous gathering of 500,000 in rural upstate New York. Far out, I thought. Afterward, I continued to fruitlessly seek a better state of mind, and 2 more years wafted by in a blur of pot and whatever other substance was handy. I was the poster child for the freewheeling 60s. In my self-imposed stupor, there was little I didn't complain about. I tried college but dropped out my 2nd year, distraught in my loneliness and with my vision of a world gone mad. In 1970, during a Washington, D.C. political demonstration, I was tear-gassed. Literally, as the caustic gas engulfed us, I met the woman who was to be my wife and the mother of my 2 children. Within weeks, with my new love in tow, I revisited the now dangerous street life of San Francisco. We lived on those streets for 2 months and then returned to upstate New York. Through it all, I balked at everything that didn't align itself with my idea of rightness, chafing at the unfairness of it all. I ranted that too many selfish people were controlling things, selfish people who were conspiring to ruin my life. Of course, I was a beacon of equanimity. In truth, I was a pain to everyone around me, while my life was a series of dead-end jobs and fleeting relationships with unhappy people not unlike myself. Profoundly unhappy, I was a narcissistic complainer, haunted by self-imposed psychic hooligans. In the middle of all this, I married my tear gas love. Not surprisingly, my bride was equally frustrated with the unfairness of life. We were 2 peas in a pod, loud and bold, convinced of our rightness and everyone else's wrongness. Then, after 6 years of wallowing in this fog existence, the chains suddenly fell off one August morning in 1973. Hungover and depressed yet again, I sat at the kitchen table in the dumpy apartment I shared with my wife. I was earning minimum wage as a seasonal worker at a recreational campsite, collecting garbage and cleaning public restrooms. I was late for work that morning, but nevertheless, I sat there immobile, looking inward. I declared to myself, essentially, I'm not living like this anymore. Until now, my point of view has been wrong. No longer will I try to change the world by whining about it and fighting it. There is very little outside myself I can control, so I will stop agonizing over those things. I will arrange to go back to school this fall to learn something that can be used to create a future. From now on, there will be no more complaining, no more blaming. Rather than rejecting the world as it's presented to me, I will get inside it, as it is, and see what I can do with the parts of it that are in my control. Little did I know that my desperate acquiescence of the system, in my mid-20s, would be the first step toward writing a book 35 years later that would point out the beauty of systems and the freedoms they can provide. But unlike my preoccupations back then, what I write about here has nothing to do with politics, esoteric theory, or right or wrong. It's about simple mechanics. I enrolled at the New York State Ranger School in the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York to study forestry and land surveying. I put my head down, worked hard through the winter, and graduated the next summer with a technical degree. Continuing to pay attention to the details, my wife and I, and our 5-month-old son, headed to Oregon with $400 in our pockets and everything we owned packed into a homemade trailer attached to the back of our Plymouth. I had made a stand. I was improving my life and the lives of the two people who were depending on me by expending my energy only on the details that I could control. The fog in my head had lifted due to an absurdly simple adjustment in my thinking process. But despite those first positive steps at dealing with the real world by focusing on what was truly in my control, I had not yet recognized the next necessary systems perspective step that would lead to actually getting the peace and prosperity I wanted. In this ignorance, I would carry some very heavy baggage for another 25 years. Perpetual disappointment. The best illustration of the baggage I carried is a photo taken at Woodstock. It's one you may have seen. It's of a lovely, slender, long-haired girl who is maybe 18 years old. She's beautiful, and she's dancing in a meadow in a long, sheer dress. There's a flower wreath in her hair, and she's laughing as she whirls with her arms stretched above her head in a casual way. Her thin, handsome, ponytailed boyfriend is dancing, too. They share a blissful peace, joy, ecstasy, and anyone who sees that photo would, at least for a moment, want to be one of those two young people. The image is a declaration of pure bliss with the clear message that unrestrained freedom and happiness are attainable, and the path to that place requires no more than a carefree and unrestrained comportment, hip music, and an unlimited supply of drugs. With a broad metaphorical brushstroke, the message of that photo is that happiness is available as soon as we drop our uptight preoccupations and dance in the meadow. Let it all hang out. Stay loose. Go with the flow. Back to the real world. The photo is an enticement for a state of mind that exists only for brief moments. Its message is a sham. One can't just lighten up and then expect ongoing happiness. Life isn't that way. But many of us who evolved from that era think it should be that way, and so we live from day to day in perpetual disappointment within a world that won't conform to our expectations. 40 years after the 60s, that silly perspective has carried over to our children and beyond. We share a culture of chronic disappointment, and it's no surprise that many of us are crass, self-absorbed, and narcissistic. We bask in wealth the world has never known, but wonder why our lives are chaotic and why we are unsatisfied. We obsess about our yearning states of mind as we grope for personal peace. Don't get me wrong as I make my points here. I don't like focusing on negatives, and this is a bit painful for me as I discuss the unhappy contortions of my generation. But it's a necessary discussion for understanding the work the system premise. So I have to start here, in the negative, in order to set the stage for the rest of the book, which I promise you will find uplifting. Dancing in the Meadow Syndrome. In the Western world, 10% of adults are alcoholics. 70% drink copious amounts of caffeine, 25% are addicted to tobacco, and more than 10% rely on antidepressants. Throw in the other legal and illegal mood-altering drugs, and it is safe to say that each day, 98% of us ingest at least one mood-altering substance in our endless search for better states of mind. Of course, many of us are multi-substance users, for instance, consuming caffeine in the morning and alcohol at night. One substance counters the negative effects of the other in the classic endless loop of Western chemical mood adjustment. The price to be paid. Abusing personal systems too often means introducing foreign substances into the miraculous near-perfect system that is the body. Perceiving themselves to be unhappy, people complicate their already flawed thinking process by contaminating themselves. The ice-cold reality? 1 + 1 = 2, and with the same utter reliability, a drunken night out on the town equals days of subpar physical and mental performance as the human body works overtime to repair itself from the chemical assault. We make things worse in the long term by violating systems in the short term, as we ignore the simple truth that disruption of an efficient system always has its price. One could say that substance abuse is a criminal attack against oneself. So we finger point and complain and wonder at our dissatisfaction. It's too bad we do that because it's not just a waste of time, it's a diversion from what needs to happen in order to find life satisfaction. Personal excuses, generalizations about the alleged dire state of the world, and under the radar as well as overt attempts to change the people around us, are ineffectual to the point of paralysis. These preoccupations are distractions from the personal actions we could take that would produce what we want in our individual lives: peace, prosperity, and control of our destinies. And pursuing personal peace, prosperity, and control are noble goals because the sure way to realize them is to contribute to the people around us. What about the generally accepted notion that someone who seeks firm control is an unpleasant personality, someone who needs to loosen up? With some rare exceptions, I submit that this ubiquitous assumption is wrong. Despite the almost visceral societal belief to the contrary, there is a direct connection between happiness and the amount of control we attain. But let's be clear. Happiness is not found in the control we have over others. It's found in the control we have over the moment-to-moment trajectory of our own lives. And more exactly, here we get to the root of things, the control of the personal systems that are ours to adjust and maintain. The solution to getting what we want and making a contribution is not in complaining about the world condition or ingesting the perfect drug. And it's not about acquiring more things or being popular or famous. The solution is rooted in adopting a different perspective, a different way of seeing, thinking, and processing things. And it's about facing the world cold turkey, courageously questioning the sacred status quo as it relates to our own selves. It's about sorting out what's going on within our individual areas of direct influence. The thinking process is a linear system, and my contention, as illustrated in the dancing girl photo, is that many of us make a fundamental error in executing that process, albeit tongue-in-cheek. I like to call this chronic thinking error the dancing in the meadow syndrome. Your circle of influence. A metaphorical concept made popular by Stephen Covey, the circle of influence describes one's ability to have an impact in life. In years past, I was hardly able to influence and control my own comings and goings due to whatever psychological funk was swallowing me up in the moment. My circle of influence felt like it was maybe 2 feet in diameter. Now, my circle feels as if it's miles in diameter, as my days effortlessly sail by and I'm able to accomplish nearly all that I set out to accomplish. This impact gives me enormous satisfaction as the wheels of progress keep turning due to my previous input, not because of my immediate presence. Take a moment to use your imagination and describe your own circle. How large is it? Is it just 6 inches in diameter? If it is, when you look down, is the 6-inch circle hidden underneath your feet? If the circle was 12 inches in height, you could barely balance on it. Do you spend all your available energy and attention just trying not to fall off? If that is your situation, your tenuous balancing effort doesn't leave much time for anything but complaining. Wherever you are, whatever the size of your circle of influence, Focus on making changes inside of it, not outside. Don't spend precious time and energy analyzing and dissecting big picture issues you cannot affect. Instead, spend that time and energy on the things you can affect, things within your circle. Do that, and your circle will expand. Life is a streaming video, not a snapshot. Outside of brief moments within that encapsulated era, the unbridled approach of the 60s was just another great idea that didn't work. It was a theory that didn't consider how we are, but how we thought we should be. If that Woodstock meadow dancing photo had instead been a documentary movie, the hours and days surrounding that dance would tell a different story. The truth of Woodstock? The nonstop music was good, but few bands played their best due to the confusion and pervasive drug ingestion. Yes, it was peaceful, but after that first glorious day, it was cold and wet, and we sat in the mud shivering, drenched, hungry, and thirsty. In the rain, 500,000 of us worked hard to relax, insistent on our success at being together outside the system for nothing more than music and love. It's all we need, we told ourselves over and over again. We had jumped outside the everyday world, but in our t-shirts, jeans, and little else, we were unprepared as the chilly torrent hammered down. It was no contest as soft theory met bare-knuckled hard reality. With the inevitability of a wave washing into shore, the enthusiasm faded as the filth that comes with neglected crowds began to accumulate. After 2 days of this, as a general paranoia swept through the wet, shivering, drug-addled horde, my friend John and I got out of there. We left before Jimi Hendrix had taken the stage. It was that bad. As we headed home in my beat-up wreck of a car listening to the radio, we were reminded of Vietnam, racial unrest, and political deviousness. And beyond those negatives, we both worked graveyard shifts in a paper mill. And as we drove north, exhausted and depressed, any joy we experienced at Woodstock was within a narrow sliver in time. John was 18 years old. I was 19. We were college dropout party guys and proud of our chaotic lifestyles. We never thought of the relationship between our self-absorbed, uncontrolled lives and our unhappiness. As I think back and make judgments, it occurs to me that the ones who were creating something worthwhile were the straight kids. They were not immune to downtimes, but in their willingness to conform to the reality of the world, they were much more in control and, yes, happier. The lure of dancing in the meadow is an invitation to illusionary bliss. Truth is, orderliness and attention to detail are the roots of peace. Proof? Consider the indisputable reverse logic. In any setting, the opposite of peace, disorder, always leads to desperation. It's this way for any out-of-control situation, a natural disaster, riot, car accident, or family argument. The outcome is never a pretty sight. Too many of us are paralyzed in the static snapshot of how we think things should be instead of working with the mechanics of the world as it is. Life is not a snapshot. It's a real-time streaming video, and the video plays on whether we participate in it or not. Distracted. So, 40 years later, what is the relevance? For those who still buy into the 60s mystique, an unfounded assumption smolders. It whispers there is chaos all around, that systems and organization are bad, and that Big Brother is right there behind the curtain, steering things in the wrong direction. This threat of paranoia leaves too many of us obsessing about things that are out of our control. And the obsessing distracts us from taking the actions that would truly make us free. It's not the system that holds us back. It's the flaw in our perception. As we focus on the events outside ourselves that we cannot control, we overlook the imperfect aspects of our own lives that we can control. We don't recognize that recurring personal pain is not often the result of a flawed world, but more usually the result of our own flawed personal systems, systems we can repair. We don't grasp that experiencing peace and prosperity, nothing less than freedom, comes from paying strict attention to the details of our own lives. If we don't overtly take control of the forward flow of our own lives, the mistake of a lifetime is just around the corner, ready to flatten us when we least expect it. More endemic and less dramatic, Small inefficiencies will take us to the same dark place. Life carries on whether we like it or not, and this churning flow is at our command only if we pay close attention to the details. Back in 1974, as my family and I moved west, what I still didn't understand was that the mindset of the people who are successful in life, the people who create and build and contribute, the ones who have poise, freedom, and wealth, is to pay attention to the mechanical details of life. I didn't understand that peace and prosperity arrive after the mechanics are in order. This requires forethought, organization, and rational thinking, and that means well-attended systems. The way of the world is mechanical. A dearth of systems. From a systems perspective, what happened at Woodstock? One system that worked well was the system that delivered the music. The technicians were adept, and the equipment functioned adequately. The musicians showed up, which meant the transportation system worked. The entertainers were delivered by helicopter. The location, Yasger's Farm, worked. What systems did not work? Outside of the above, you name it. The ticketing system failed, with all the surrounding fences coming down early in the process, a disaster for the promoters who sponsored the event. The sanitation and medical systems were overwhelmed and borderline dysfunctional. If overt police protection had been required, it would have been mayhem because it was little more than a tiny contingent of informal private security guards. Of course, from a personal systems perspective, few in the audience were physically prepared, even in a rudimentary way. To compound things, drug use was hampering rational thinking. Everyone was in the middle of everything, and chaos was a breath away, held back by no more than the luck of the draw. One day of peace and music? Yes, okay, that's true. 2 days? Well, the drugs helped maintain a certain calmness, but things were stretched. 3 days? Phew, it was an exodus out of there. If there had been 4 days, for those diehards who might have remained, it would have been a sordid, nasty affair. It was the love and goodwill of the people that made the festival work. But that sliver of bliss time was narrow and can't serve as an example of how a life can be lived day to day. I love you, man, is not enough for the long term. Illustration. A potent, visceral reminder from the folks at NASA. A space shuttle is arguably the most complex machine ever built by man, and a launch is perhaps the most magnificent display of human system control. I never miss an opportunity to watch the event on TV in real time. The next time you watch a launch, consider the precision of the countdown, which relies on thousands of simultaneous and automatic monitoring processes, all overseen by engineers and technicians. The launch executes, and tens of thousands of active systems, both on the craft and on the ground, execute independently and in concert, each a precision entity unto itself. As of the publication date of this book, there have been 127 flights, two of which were spectacularly horrible failures. Yet, considering the incredible complexity of the endeavor, and acknowledging the human penchant for error, one could legitimately wonder why there have not been more catastrophes than this. Like countless minor failures of the past, these tragedies provide space shuttle engineers with information they can use to prevent future problems. As time moves on, the chances of minor and major failure decrease steadily as the space shuttle system is tweaked ever closer to perfection. As you watch the next liftoff, the keynote celebration of human potential and a potent visceral illustration of the beauty of the countless systems that comprise our existences, consider the following question while you marvel at the miracle. Could space shuttle system improvements, most of which are based on advances in science, engineering, and mathematics, but many of which are based on previous failure, be the result of an outside and slightly elevated vantage point?